Fly By Night is the secret story of Steven Spielberg, Warner Brothers, and the Twilight Zone deaths. It's not for, it's coming out for 40 years since, well, it's 40 years since the accident happened on the film set of the Twilight Zone. The idea began as a contest between the two hot young gunslinging Hollywood directors of the time, between Steven Spielberg and John Landis. John Landis gleefully named his venture Fly By Night. He even painted it on the nose of the helicopter used in the film. It was a joke until the helicopter crash, killing actor Vic Morrow and two children who'd been hired illegally. What happened next was a tale of subterfuge, defeat, and the power of Hollywood and the studios. It is the subject of a new book called Fly By Night, the secret story of Steven Spielberg, Warner Brothers, and the Twilight Zone deaths. It's by Stephen Chan. I'm delighted to be joining me live on the line by Stephen himself. Stephen, good afternoon from us. Good morning to you.
Hey, good afternoon.
Good to have you with us. Explain to us a little bit about the concept behind the movie, The Twilight Zone, because it was four individual directors, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. The idea was to make us a low-budget film with the sort of the four. It was called, at this time, it was 1982. It was a big movement among young directors, as you know, as you noted in your introduction. And it basically, Steven Spielberg was very hot at the time, and he was very close to John Landis. They were sort of friends, very active. Each of them had their projects, were very successful. John Landis, of course, with Animal House, and Steven Spielberg at the time had his greatest success with E.T. and Poltergeist. So basically, they decided, I guess, together that they were going to put together, do a revival of a very prominent TV show over here in America, which was, as you know, Twilight Zone. And so they invited film director Joe Dante, who later did Gremlins, and the Australian director George Miller to join the project. Each one of them would do a small short, a quarter of the film. The whole film would consist of four portions. And basically, Spielberg and Landis, I mean, it was in particular, John Landis, felt that he wanted to, as you mentioned in your introduction, compete with Steven Spielberg. It was kind of like a thing, who could produce the greatest, you know, the highest quality film for the least amount of money, hence the term Fly By Night. And the reason those terms were picked, as they were actually Warner. It was a Warner production. That's what the book is all about. And how this Warner production basically slid into a disaster and what Warner did to cover it up.
What sort of order did they shoot in? Because it's four individual films. So were they all shooting around the same area? What was the timeline on this? Because at the time, remember, I mean, George Miller, Mad Max films, obviously, yes. So that's a huge thing. Joe Dante, these were the hottest young sort of gunslingers, if you like, at the time.
Well, I mean, among the three of them, all of their production was supervised directly by Warner and the Warner production. Landis insisted on completely independent production, which I describe in the book. And you're not really familiar with how the studios, I guess, are set up over here in Los Angeles. But Warner was basically in one part of town, Universal nearby. And Landis insisted that his production remain off campus, so to speak. And that's why they use the term Fly By Night basically from the beginning, because one of the reasons these small production companies pick names like this is to obtain the best deals from the various suppliers and keep the prices low. If the provider of equipment or trucking or whatever the services for the film may be comes in as Warner, they tend to get a higher bid on the they charge them a little more for the production. If they come in with a small independent appearing name, the various suppliers tend to make better deals. So hence the names are picked and used. And that's where the whole thing came from.
And thinking back to the actual movie, those little sort of episodes themselves, correct me, because it's been a while, I'm pretty getting this wrong, but George Miller's was the sky demon on the aircraft. correct?
Right, right. Each of them.
Yeah, and then Joe Dante's was the kid in the house who terrified because right. he's got this power that he, you know, his imagination can make anything happen.
Each of them picked their own story, and they worked with the studio. The thing about the Landis portion was he was very proud that he was the only one to write his own story.
Yeah.
Which, of course, was modified by the studio, requiring that they do certain things to make the character more empathetic. The Landis segment, as you know, was about the trans. It's interesting because it was basically it was supposed to be a lesson in racism. The character in the Landis segment was a guy who went through a transformative process, entering the Twilight Zone, so to speak, and having his racism revealed.
And the actor they hired, that Landis hired for the movie, Vic Morrow. I mean, for those who aren't familiar with him, you know, what was his? He was well known, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, he was a very prominent figure in American television. And it was a show called Combat, which was basically a documentary-like show. I mean, it was a dramatic portrayal of World War II encounters, mostly in Germany and against the Germans. And, you know, it was about soldiers in Europe. And Morrow was the lead character. And basically his career had fallen apart after that show was canceled. It's still on television in North America. I don't know if it's shown in Europe still. But That project fell apart for him, and he sort of fell apart. And that, you know, that 1982 was sort of the biggest year for cocaine usage in Hollywood. And apparently Vic Morrow himself was a victim of severe cocaine addiction for a while. And this was an attempt to kind of revive his career and put him back on the Hollywood map.
The thing that interests me is all the other episodes I talk about are sort of quite contained, but Landis went for the big Vietnam situation with a helicopter.
His big goal was the explosions, and that's where he got into trouble, of course, by deliberately detonating an explosive underneath the helicopter, which was hovering at 20 feet above Vic Morrow and the two kids. And of course, the complete recklessness of his decision brought the helicopter down. The explosion went off immediately below the tail rotor and crashed the helicopter on Vic and the two kids. They didn't really have a chance.
And what happened was we have the death of Vic Morrow and these two. I mean, how old were these kids? I mean, they were
6 and 7, respectively. And as you know from knowing the story, Vic and the little boy, Mika Lee, the Vietnamese boy, was decapitated. The two of them were decapitated, and the young girl, Miss Chen, was crushed to death in front of her mother.
Horrendous. What I'm still sort of stunned that they carried on, if you like, and I mean, they've re-edited the ending of that particular episode.
Well, as you know, the children were hired illegally to be on the set, and what the fly in the ointment was that a fire marshal who was on the set because of the estimate, in order to set off the special effects, you have to apply with the city to get a permit. So that because of the special effects, they had to have fire marshals on the set. One of the fire marshals who showed up was also a child welfare officer. And one of the people on the production crews, who was very close to the Spielberg, he had actually been on the earlier Spielberg films, the location manager, in this case his name was Dick Vane, spotted this guy who was the police, basically the child welfare officer, and reported it to Landis and the rest of the crew. And they, in order to avoid being detected, they elaborated this giant concealment scheme, which the prosecution, which the police didn't find out about for about a year, while Warner knew all along, which was part of what I explained in the book. From Warner internal documents, I was able to learn that within the first week of the crash, they knew everything and had concealed it from authorities. And rather than being a good corporate citizen and coming forward and making it easy to understand what caused the crash, they did everything, I believe, in their power to conceal it.
It seems incredible, doesn't it? Because especially in the light of what happened, you know, recently on the set of Rust, and just as we got different times. But I mean, did they pay hush money? I mean, you've had this you know, two kids killed and the actor. I mean, what does Morrow's immediate family do? I mean, what, because I'm just stunned that they kind of got away with it so long. You know, was Warner that powerful? They could do that.
Well, they're very powerful, because if you want to work in Hollywood, you cooperate with the studios and you don't become what they call a stooge, or you don't break the Hollywood code of silence. And people on the set did not, rather than come to authorities for counsel and direction, they came to the Warner lawyers for counsel and direction. And essentially, the lawyers, in my opinion, from my review of these documents that were provided by a Warner insider who was sickened by what he saw happen on that set, indicates that they basically ran a campaign with Los Angeles's largest legal establishments to conceal the evidence that occurred on the set. And basically, by doing that, delayed the investigation for almost a year, until finally a grand jury discovered evidence that the people on the grand jury were able to issue an indictment. That took a year. And then by that time, evidence disappears, memories fade, people die. It's very hard to prosecute a case. And then beyond that time, they delayed another 3 years. So the case never even came to trial for 5 years, 4 years. So by that time, very hard to run a case, and the prosecution on the case was very poorly prepared. And there's some discussion about why those particular prosecutors were picked in the prosecutor's office. Obviously, Los Angeles and the prosecutor's office very closely tied to the film industry.
Mm. The families of the kids who were killed. I mean, the kids are working illegally. Presumably, you would have thought that they, you know, Warner Brothers would have been nailed to the wall for this. So how did they, was it just a case of they threw money at the problem so they went to, I mean, Vic Morrow's daughters were also contacted, weren't they? They were also sort of, were they?
Well, Vic Morrow, he had two daughters, one of whom is a famous movie star, Jennifer Jason Leigh. Mm. And they were estranged at the time. He wasn't a very good father, apparently. She was very disgusted with his behavior, and she wouldn't even talk to him, and he had written her out of the will to begin with. She actually ended up getting more money because he died in this horrendous situation. Had he died of natural causes, I think he wrote her into the will for $100. The other daughter, Carrie, she was very close to Vic, and the two of them obviously got hooked up with legal counsel and ended up settling for very little, I think under $1 million for the two of them, stretched over a long period of time. The children, on the other hand, their parents, because of the strange aspects of the law, were entitled to a much greater recovery at the time, because they actually witnessed the death of their children, which some weird aspect of the law entitles you to more money if you have to endure that aspect of it. I think the little girl's parents got about $1.7 million, and the boy's parents got about $1.3
million. Mm.
And that was all confidential at the time, was stretched over a period of time, and seemed like a very modest amount to me.
I mean, Landis, you would think, would have been in...
And, oh, by the way, these compensations were not paid out of Landis's or even Warner's pocket, for that matter. They were paid by the insurance companies and Warner. And basically, it didn't affect the directors in any way. In fact, Landis went on to, I think, made a couple $1 million on this film.
Well, this is the thing, because I mean, I remember reading it, and as a young teenage film buff, I remember and liking that sort of science fiction stroke weird films. I remember the case of, I remember seeing the video of the crash, for goodness sake, and they're reporting on the death of Morrow, and then you would think they would have shut it down. But they recut the ending of the film, so that Morrow gets blown in an explosion, into the segment where he's put in the trains at the end and heads off to you think the camps because he's anti Jewish and gets picked up by the Nazis, and they just sort of they cut it and had the. We could say they had the lack of empathy to carry on and put out the project.
Yeah, well, it's amazing how powerful the studios are. And of course, Hollywood is the land of illusion. And obviously, you know, just before the show, just for the heck of it, I looked up on Wikipedia, see how it described it, how it described John Landis. And it didn't even mention the death of the children in one entry. It just said, oh, he was accused of hiring children illegally on the set of the making of the Twilight Zone. It's amazing how the history can be rewritten through the process of illusion, which is what Hollywood's all about.
And
but
the
yes,
thing,
it's true.
The other thing
is, the film ended up making a lot of money, actually, and it was a very low budget production. So in that respect, it's very similar to the Rust. You had mentioned the Rust production today with Alec Baldwin. And, you know, similar conditions existed on that set as well. And one of the goals on that set, and one of the reasons the Rust mishap occurred, was because of the keeping the budget low and hiring low skilled people, which is the same thing that happened on the Twilight Zone, and taking advantage of these people who are, you know, not prepared to perform well on the set. In the Rust case, there's a very strong likelihood that Baldwin, the problem Alec Baldwin has, is both the perpetrator of what happened on the set. He was also a producer, so he was not simply an actor, and in that respect, that's where his legal liability becomes much broader, because he can be held responsible for what happened on the set because he was put on notice with earlier gunfire and mishaps.
One of the other things is the fact that, you know, this is going in front of a jury, and the peculiar situation with Hollywood is that juries get starstruck and they go, yeah. Oh, I mean, we only have to look at what's going on at the moment on TV with the blanket coverage of, you know, Depp and Heard. And people go, oh, they've got their opinions on this. So put yourself in the situation where they're having, you know, a jury of, you know, 12 people, whatever it was, are having to decide on the case. And Spielberg is the hottest thing in Hollywood, as is Landis, because of Animal House and also Blues Brothers, etc. And they got starstruck.
Well, not to mention the fact that during the trial, it was a constant stream of movie stars in front of, including Landis's good friend Dan Aykroyd and Carrie Fisher from the Star Wars, and many, many people. Michelle Pfeiffer was there, songwriter Randy Newman, the guy who ran Disney, Jeff Katzenberg. I mean, all of the Landis supporters. I mean, first of all, most of them didn't know really what happened on the set. And by the time the case came to trial, it was so confusing for the prosecution. They didn't know where they were going. They basically wanted to appeal to the emotion of the jury. And without giving away what happens at the end of the book, I don't want to describe how the jury responded, but obviously everybody knows they were acquitted. I think readers might be amazed why the jury made that decision, which is, like I said, I don't want to give away the end.
Of course.
But it's a somewhat of a Twilight Zone ending, I thought, and humorous in that respect, and ironic, but the readers will have to get a copy of the book to find out how it ends.
I mean, you would think that this sort of accident would have repercussions on the directors to the producers, but obviously Spielberg goes on to produce, you know, the movies that we know him for. Landis, you know, did this have an effect on Landis's? Because he was known for his stunts, wasn't he? I mean, you think about the Blues Brothers.
I mean, Landis was very successful during the whole five-year process from crash to trial, 1982, 1987. And during that period, he had some of his greatest successes subsequent to Animal House. His greatest movie that he made during that period was the Trading Places film with Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy. I don't know if you know that film.
Absolutely.
But it was very
absolutely
successful in North America. And actually, on a daily basis, he brought people from the Trading Places film, Ralph Bellamy and Don Ameche, the two guys who were the lead stars in that film, apart from his other people. And they were constant faces in the crowd, which the jury found very impressive and I'm sure played a very important role under their decision-making process.
And it was that sort of, you say, that Saturday Night Live crowd, they were the young guns. If you think about, you know, you say Chevy Chase, Jamie Lee Curtis, of course, she was in Trading Places, Carrie Fisher, and they were a party crowd, and people pretty much got blown away by it, didn't they?
Yeah, well, I mean, you talk about jury members. as well as the public. Yeah, well, I mean, the news media, they were impressed, of course, and they were reporting on the trial. So they were very starstruck themselves. These are the local reporters, Los Angeles Times Examiner, and then the national press, and then there was the UPI reporter who constantly covered the case. They were very impressed by the starstruck. Landis himself brought the stars to the trial on a daily basis. And, you know, it was a pretty impressive case. It had a lot of glamour to it. And people really, in fact, they never presented the evidence of the gore that appeared on that set. For some reason, the prosecutor agreed with the, in the very beginning of the case, they limit what kind of evidence can be presented. Mm. And for some unknown reason, the prosecutor, perhaps she thought it would be too dramatic, agreed with the defense attorneys not to introduce the horrible photographs of what the parents saw on the set that night, which I always believe would have been a much more important piece of evidence to show the jury, to give them a real gut feeling. Mm. We provide that evidence in the book.
So how did you get hold of that sort of evidence, and why do you think it was important to revisit this? Because Spielberg is now being venerated. He's got, you know, he had West Side Story out this year. You know, he's still creating. Is it a warning tale about the power of the studio system, and when you let directors go, you know, off on their own fuel, shall we say, ideas?
I mean, it's all about the bottom line, let's face it. I mean, when Warner's made a fortune from their relationship with these directors, especially with Steven Spielberg, not only Warner, but all the studios, and they go crazy. They compete against one another to sign them up. This is basically a story of how the studio kept the pressure of the authorities and the police and the district attorney away from Spielberg. I mean, that's what it's all about, the story. And the documents from Warner show how this kind of campaign was conducted, and they were very successful. And the big witness on this, who was actually on the scene that night, who was Spielberg's leading associate, a fellow named Frank Marshall, literally disappeared from sight for 5 years, spent most of his time in England, staying outside the jurisdiction of the court and the district attorney, and never cooperated with authorities. And has never apologized to this day.
Do you think that this could, I mean, we live now in an era where people are, you know, snapping things on their phones left, right, and center. Things get tweeted. Do you think this sort of case could still, do you think they could pull this one again? Are we seeing the same thing now with the Rust movie?
Well, I mean, ultimately it has to do with administration and money. I mean, if you follow the money, you realize that they, on the Rust case, they hired people, for example, the lady who was supposed to be responsible for the weapons that were used, a 24-year-old, never been on a movie before. She'd been on one movie before with Nicolas Cage before this film. Mm. She was hired to wear two hats, to be both a prop assistant and someone responsible for the weapons. They're called armors. Yeah. That's the official title they use. And at one point, she was reprimanded for spending too much time tending the guns and problems of that nature. In fact, when Alec Baldwin, what he claims is he didn't pull the trigger, but he cocked the gun and released it. And that's what caused the discharge of the weapon. But at that point, she wasn't even in the room. Mm. That evidence has not come out at this point. Who ordered the gun to be handed to Alec Baldwin when the woman responsible was not even present? That issue hasn't even come out. And my understanding is if they can provide enough evidence to show that Alec Baldwin himself was involved with the first assistant director, that would be evidence sufficient for an indictment, because it would show he, as a producer, violated the standards of safety, which he was responsible to know. In other words, the idea would be that he had a greater duty to know about what happened on the set because he was a producer as well as an actor.
It's interesting as well, because we, you know, films are being made on low budgets, and this particular film, you know, The Twilight Zone was on fly by night, as you say before, and, you know, people are trying to, you know, cut costs. And when you cut costs and you do stunts or weapons, or in this case, you know, explosions with helicopters, then you are running a very dangerous case, a very dangerous line indeed.
Well, in the case of the Twilight Zone movie, when Fly By Night is a as a production company, went out to buy things or to hire people, they always hired the people who were most compliant, who would be most flexible, and would be most who would bend under the influence of John Landis, who was known at the time for a guy who was very emotional on the set, screamed at people, cursed, and was known for humiliating the staff. So he was only, when they pursue the different staff members, they hire them with that specific goal in mind. And my belief is on the Rust movie, they did the same, which is why I believe there's a very strong likelihood that Baldwin may be indicted.
Do you find that, do you find Twilight Zone a difficult watch now that you know that you discovered? I mean, have you seen it knowing what happens?
Well, you know, it's hard to inject. I mean, you tend to, when you see a film, you see it for what it is. You don't see how the production was conducted or what the controversial aspects, as I mentioned to you. In some, when you look it up online, in some cases, it doesn't even mention that the three dead people were the result of that film. So the filmmakers and Warner and the other, the illusion makers have been very successful in obliterating what really happened on the set that night, which is such a horrible disaster and gory as heck, as you know.
Yeah, the book is called Fly By Night, The Secret Story of Steven Spielberg, Warner Brothers, and the Twilight Zone Deaths. It's by Stephen Chan, who we've been speaking to today. Stephen, if people want to find more information about you, is there a website? Are you online? Where can they look you up, Stephen?
Well, I mean, the Amazon site actually contains a great bio, better than I could write myself. So if you go to the Amazon, being very computer illiterate myself, I never realized that when an author comes out with a book, they publish a full scale bio. And that is really the best place where you can find it without going to a website. I do have an Instagram site that your listeners can go to. It's Fly By Night Book.
Fly By Night book. The book is called Fly By Night. It's by Stephen Chan, who we'll be speaking to today. Stephen, thank you so much for your time today.
And thank you.